Just a moment. Just a moment.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast, exploring where the law has been.
Hey Siri, take a selfie.
And where it's going.
Oh, good afternoon.
From the brilliant.
My name is Sophia, and I am the latest and greatest robot.
To the scary.
Just what do you think you're doing, Dave?
And everything in between. Please welcome your very real and very human host, Mike Madison.
Welcome to the Future Law Podcast. This is your host, Professor Michael Madison of the University of Pittsburgh in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. The Future Law Podcast comes back again and again to some key themes, and one of those is leadership. Leadership by lawyers, leadership education and development for lawyers. My guest today is a lawyer. In fact, he and I became friends several decades ago. We graduated from law school together. But he was an officer in the U.S. Marine Corps before getting a law degree and also a business degree, and he was commissioned in the Marine Corps when he graduated from the U.S. Naval Academy. Today, after a successful career as an entrepreneur and venture capitalist in Silicon Valley, he has returned to the Academy in Annapolis, Maryland, on the Chesapeake Bay. His name is Michael Sears, and he is the Director of Leadership Innovation at the Boeing Leadership Innovation Laboratory in the Stockdale Center for Ethical Leadership. Our conversation took us through leadership training in the modern military and how that speaks to the future of law.
Michael Sears, it's great to reconnect in this podcast format. How are you doing today?
Mike, it's been a long time. It's always good to chat with you, and I'm looking forward to this conversation.
Thanks. So at the U.S. Naval Academy today, what does your role entail as the Director of Leadership Innovation?
Leadership innovation is all about trying to bring the tools and techniques and processes, and frankly, the mindset that I was able to employ over the last 35 years in the Silicon Valley, and try to match that with the ways we're teaching character, leadership, and law at the Naval Academy. The best way I can describe that is that from an ethics standpoint, the best way to be a person of virtue is to live a long life and learn from that life. Gray hair, bald hair, whatever. It's just age and experience. The second best way is to actually try to connect emotionally with the subject matter so you can make decisions, kind of a flight simulator type affair. So you can actually get in there, see what's going on, make a decision, might be the right decision, might be the wrong decision. By the way, there were very few right or wrong decisions. You just make a decision and then you get feedback and you learn from it and then rinse and repeat. So I'm bringing simulation tools to the pedagogy of ethics, character, and law.
So can you give us an example in practice of what that looks like on the ground with your colleagues and students?
Sure. There's a very famous ethical dilemma called the trolley problem. And the trolley problem, I'll be real brief here because probably a lot of your listeners probably have heard of it. The idea is you're the switch person. You're the switchman in a railroad track. So you're the person who actually diverts or changes the direction of a trolley that's running down the track. Now, in this situation, there's a trolley coming down the track. At the end of that track, there are five workers who are working on that track. The trolley is out of control. The brakes have failed. So that trolley is going to go down and smash into those guys because they don't know it's coming down the track. You see it, and you can make the decision to actually shift that trolley from the main line to a spur line. The only issue is on that spur line, there's one person standing there and he or she doesn't know a trolley is coming down the track. So it's your call. It's your decision to actually move the trolley from the main line to that spur line. Now, the other way to look at that is those five guys at the end of that main line, they're dead in a metaphysical sense. If you do nothing in 30 seconds, those people will be run over and killed. If you intervene, you're actually getting involved in this situation, moving the train from that main line to the spur line. So you're the cause of that one person being killed. Now, it's not murder. You might have a duty. There's a lot of ways to actually look at that. But the question here from an ethical standpoint is, do you get involved or do you not get involved? Now, that's the trolley problem where I come in. What we're doing in the lab is we are able to present that scenario, in a sense, on your mobile phone. And you go through the trolley problem. You make the decision as to whether or not you're going to play God and get and intervene and, I'm doing air quotes here, kill that one person or do nothing and let those five people die. Now, based on your decision, what we'll do, what my philosophers and ethicists will do is we'll kind of print to screen. All right, so you decided to do nothing. So those five people died. Well, let's change that scenario and run it again. Again, just like a flight simulator. We're changing the weather pattern or the type of airplane you're flying or whatever, but we're going to run that pattern again. And instead of five people at the end of that line and one person on the spur line, now there are five convicted felons. What are you going to do now? Okay, does that change the way you think about your decision-making? Are those felons less than those five people? Okay, depending on how you answer that question, we'll change it again. And there might we might leave the five felons on that track. But that one person on that spur line is now a seven-year-old girl with a little teddy bear. What are you going to do? Now, the whole point of this is, as I said earlier, there's no right answer here. But we're offering the user or the viewer different scenarios so he or she can actually, you know, go through the process, the emotional process of making those decisions, and then actually getting some feedback from a trained PhD philosopher based on that decision. One more point. The important thing there is it's one-on-one. You're not in a classroom where there might be 20 or 30 other students or a lot more, where you're raising your hand, there's peer pressure, all that, or you might not be paying attention. This is a set of tools that can be delivered to you on your phone or on your tablet or on your PC. And you can experience this with the sights and sounds, not smells yet. We'll get there in time. But you can experience that scenario and make a decision. And depending on what you do, you can try it again and try it again and try it again.
You anticipated my question, which is, how do you connect up this one-on-one learning experience to broader questions of conduct, leadership, et cetera, in social settings when you're in the actual behavioral context, when actual service, practice, putting these skills to use, there are other people, other real people involved. How do you make that link in the training from the tablet and the counseling and the conversation to actually experience it in a group setting?
Great question, Mike. And here's the answer. We're not disintermediating the professors, the lawyers here, because what happens in a sense is that we're logging all of those decisions independently from all of the folks in the class. So the prof can actually, once everyone runs through the scenario one-on-one by themselves, hopefully before class, the prof can actually see all of the decisions of his or her class. Now, why is that important? Well, the professor can now start fine-tuning his or her lecture, in a sense, or interaction with the class based on what she already knows about what the class is thinking. I'll be honest with you, in most of those scenarios, most of the gameplay where the little seven-year-old girl, where there's a decision about the little seven-year-old girl, it splits from a gender standpoint. And mostly females don't run over the little girl. Many 18-year-old boys do. That's interesting to me. And hopefully to some professors, and that prof can sit there and actually spend a little bit more time on that, on the why. I don't know why it necessarily is, but she can get into the class discussion, that little gem of wisdom.
In what respects does the concept that animates this project, so the idea of grounded, case-specific conversations around, as you said, ethics, virtue, and law, how does that concept continue the tradition of teaching and training at the Naval Academy? And in what respects is it a departure and an innovation relative to the traditional or classic curriculum?
two ways I'll answer that. Number one, when you graduate from the Naval Academy, you get two pieces of paper. One piece of paper is your diploma. So you get a BS in something. Okay. The other piece of paper, now, one of the things about all the military academies in the U.S. is we hire all of our graduates. So you get a commissioning note. The Congress tells you that you're an officer and a gentleman or a gentlewoman, and you are in fact an officer in the United States Naval Service. Now, why do I say that? Because every year, every midshipman, every student at the Naval Academy goes into my building, which is the Leadership Ethics and Law building. Every year, everyone takes a leadership ethics and law course. You can't graduate from this place without coming into this building. You might be a history major, you might be an aerospace engineering major, you might be a chemistry major, but you're going to come to our department every year to take an ethics class, a character class, a leadership class, a law class. So that what I'm doing is increasing the scope of the professors who are here to let them get a little deeper into or change up a little bit. You know, back in year in my day, it was always Professor Kingsfield, right? You know, in the paper chase. And yeah, I still, that's how I learned the law. Today, I'm thinking that most students don't necessarily learn that law by this wise old man standing in the front of the room with the Facebook. And I'm not talking about the digital Facebook. I'm talking about, you know, pictures and calling on people. There's a lot of different ways to learn. And what we're doing in the lab is bringing more tools, more arrows in the quiver of the professors so they can make better decisions on how they teach. That's the whole idea here.
So I have two reactions to that. One is it sounds quite a bit like you're bringing your Silicon Valley mindset and career to bear on your current role. And secondly, it sounds quite a bit like there's a lot of continuity in the teaching tradition, if not in the teaching methodologies that you're using at the Service Academy. And that part strikes me because when I teach leadership to my law students, I will often have a group of people that's diverse in terms of backgrounds. I will sometimes have people who have served in one of the branches of the U.S. military services, and of course, many students who have not. And in that diverse community, I will have the non-veterans will have a stereotype of what leadership means and what leadership represents. And when they hear from somebody who's got a Marine Corps or Navy or Air Force or Army background, they stereotype the leadership position in the Service Academy as a very command-driven, top-down, give orders and expect people to follow them kind of a mindset. And what I'm hearing in your description of your project is a lot of continuity. That's not really the way that the Service Academies teach and train. That it's a much more well-rounded, holistic approach that you're really updating the curriculum and techniques for the modern generation.
You know, point really well noted. I'm a Marine. Okay. I'm the Commandant of the Marine Corps told me, even though I left the Marine Corps 35 years ago, I can still call myself a Marine. And I probably still walk around like that. When we met all those years ago, I probably still seem like a Marine, having left the service just a few years before that. But here's the point. You know, you would think a typical stereotype of a Marine is you bark orders and someone charges the hill. That doesn't happen. I mean, sometimes it does happen. I mean, sometimes it's just really, really tight and you got to charge the hill. But 99.5% of the time, it's not a dialogue. It's not a discussion. But you as the leader have to make sure that you can empathize and understand your Marines and sailors and the people you're working with and try to figure out the best way to make sure they hear what your message is, to make sure they understand why you're doing what you're doing, and then make sure that you can facilitate all the things they need so they can go and prototypically or attack the hill in a sense. So, you know, the freshmen, we call them plebes here, the freshman level leadership course is not about leadership. It's actually about followership. What the freshmen do, what the plebes do in their course is they learn how to follow. The reason you want to learn how to follow is because you can actually then understand what the leader is doing. Then we've got the ethics course as sophomore. Then we have a leadership course. You kind of jump from the plebe to the junior, and now you understand the fundamentals of how to follow. You understand what it is to be an ethical person of virtue, to make those hard decisions, to attack the hill or not attack the hill, et cetera, et cetera. And now you're bringing it all together and saying, all right, now you're the leader. You're a junior in college. Now you're the leader. How do you stitch all these things together? We're not done yet. The next year as a senior, all of a sudden, you start realizing there might be some leadership and ethics principles here, but then you kind of lay the law into it. So let me go back to the trolley problem, right? There are ethical decisions you can make whether or not you throw the switch or not. But I got to tell you, once you, if you throw that switch, you might have the sheriff coming and looking at you. It's not an ethical issue anymore. It might be a criminal issue where the law kind of overlays on the ethics and the leadership issues. So again, what we're doing with our students and is making sure we understand all of that kind of stuff so that we can be better leaders out there. No, you don't bark orders. Sometimes you try to, but you got to really make sure in all of those other times, it's just the day-to-day stuff you do either in garrison, on a ship, or in a combat zone. You got to make sure your folks understand who you are and how you lead. It's usually not firing a bullet or firing a missile.
You had a long career as an investor and as a business person in Silicon Valley after we finished our time together in school years ago. And it was really at the conclusion of that long career in the Valley that you decided to transition back to Annapolis and take up the role that you're in. And I'm curious about your motivations. Like what inspired you or what prompted you to make that transition back to really to where you had your first educational experience as a midshipman at the Naval Academy?
You know, I had 30 years in the Valley. I did a whole bunch of the investing. I actually was a startup CEO. My wife calls it a random walk in the Silicon Valley, but I had a blast. It was a lot of fun doing all those different things. My wife, for her, she was at eBay and PayPal and Sun Microsystems, so she had her little technology experience also as a tech worker. I was lucky enough to, again, air quotes here, retire a couple of years ago. And quite frankly, Mike, I failed retirement. Okay. I needed to do more. I felt like there's more to do, out there. And that's probably, I'm in the place I need to be right now. And what I mean by that is just contributing, giving back. I'm not going to call this a labor of love. I do get paid. It pays my mortgage and all that kind of stuff. More fundamentally, I really do enjoy interacting with my colleagues and with the students to try to help them be better prepared than I was 40 some odd years ago when I hit the fleet. So it really is the idea that I don't play golf. I don't, do all those things. I did all the honey-do lists that my wife had for me. So I started looking out there, what else can I do to kind of give back? Because there's no question. I've had a wonderful career so far, but I clearly am standing on the shoulders of a lot of people, my family, my colleagues, my friends. The Naval Academy was an important part of the foundation of who I am. It's not the only part because there's a lot of different factors here, but there was an opportunity to come back here and actually work. So I jumped at it.
Let me put you on the spot with a couple of questions here. One is, let me set this up in the following way. Let's treat the Naval Academy, let's treat the U.S. Naval Service as a profession, like a military career as a profession, whether it's the Navy, the Air Force, any of the service branches. What can the Silicon Valley senior CEO investor teach the Navy? What did you learn over a career in the Valley that gives you a distinctive value proposition to improve the educational experience or the professional experience of the Naval Service?
The biggest thing that I brought to my current role is the idea of risk. And let me come back to that in a second. as a person in the military, we consider ourselves, it's a calling. Okay. I actually think being a lawyer is a calling. You don't necessarily have to be a member of the bar and practice every day, but just to go through that process, it's a calling. No, we're not priests or ministers and all that kind of stuff, but as a military person, as a lawyer, I think it's a calling. One of the things in the military, that, you know, we're really invested in what we're doing. We will give the utmost, you know, et cetera, et cetera. We will, Memorial Day was not that long ago. There are hundreds of thousands of Americans who have given the ultimate sacrifice because of that calling. They will jump out of airplanes. They will swim long distances. They will stay up late at night and, you know, do it. The risk is, the physical risk isn't really an issue. You know, to be able to land in a high-performance aircraft on a pitching deck at night is a thrill, and it's scary as heck, okay? To jump out of an airplane on the end of a rope, you know, not an airplane, a helicopter on the rope and rappel down, et cetera, et cetera. So the physical risk isn't the issue. The thing that we did in the Valley that probably, and I'm going to sound like an arrogant Silicon Valley person, but let me just go for a second. The difference is our approach to the rest of the story, and that's that risk. You start a company, it might work. 6 months later, it's not working. You shut it down. You do it again, and you do it again, and you do it again. You can't do that in the military, okay? We hire our own, but you can't come in sideways as a colonel in the military. You've got to build your career. So it's hard to take those non-physical risks, those professional risks. And the thing that I think I'm bringing to the party here, not sure how successful I am, but the thing I'm bringing to the party is just a different look at a risk profile. You got to move fast. Okay. You got to fail fast. And that's scary to people when I use that word fail. I'm not talking about crashing the airplane. Okay. I'm not talking about, I mean, you got to accomplish the mission, but what you need to do is figure out the next step and the next step and the next step and be incredibly agile. And what we said in the Silicon Valley all the time is you want to throw your employee card in the middle of the table, which is, I'm going to go for it. Okay. If it blows up, they're going to fire me. And I'm bringing a little bit, just a teeny bit of that attitude to, number one, what we're doing in the military. But Mike, the military is easy when you start talking about academia, when you start talking about professors and the administration and colleges. Please don't delete this part of the podcast, Mike, but you know how hard it is to herd the cats in academia and talk about risk there. That's what I'm hopefully bringing to the table.
Well, as they say in other contexts, culture eats strategy for breakfast.
Absolutely.
And academic culture is, it's worth a whole extended podcast of its own.
Yeah.
But you know, as you say, military culture is its own thing and Silicon Valley culture is its own thing. So I'm just sort of trying to draw out a bit of a cross-pollination. Let me turn the question in reverse. What do you think, so the Silicon Valley community and the professional services that go into making that ecology thrive? What could that community learn from the military service or the service academies?
You know, that's one of the things I've been learning since I've been here. I'm coming up on 3 years now. And quite frankly, I've been smacked in the face many, many times. We talked about this earlier with the processes and procedures. Now, the reality here is building an aircraft carrier and operating an aircraft carrier is a heck of a lot of work. It's harder than Google. Okay. It really is harder than Google. So there's constraints and governors in place to make sure you can successfully get there. What the Valley can learn from the rest of us, and I really do, it's not just the government. It really is, you know, again, I'm going to be very parochial and talk about that little stretch of land between San Francisco, the Golden Gate Bridge, and San Jose, the Valley. There are many other technology hubs around the world, around the nation, around the world. But I'll just play with the Silicon Valley for a second. What we need to understand is there's a bigger world out there. It's not just about drinking lattes and, you know, having massages at 2 o'clock in the afternoon and, you know, that kind of stuff. And I'm not saying all people in the Silicon Valley do that, but we need to respect the fact that there are many different ways to do work, and there are pretty substantial things out there beyond the digital significance of the Silicon Valley. We need to not necessarily slow down, but have the respect that there are many different ways of working out there. That's one of the things I've learned here. I'm still going to continue to fight the battle as if I'm a Silicon Valley person, but I'm a lot more respectful and understanding of all the things that my colleagues in academia and in defense industries have to go through.
I feel like a lot of the conversation that we've been having is operating at two levels. There's both the level of your actual practice today and your actual career in Silicon Valley before you came back to the Naval Academy. And then in the background, there's a kind of an unstated metaphorical level in which we're talking about law and lawyers and the legal profession. And you did mention that law is a part of the curricular pathway that your midshipmen experience in your program at the Naval Academy. But I wondered if we could talk directly about law and lawyers for the last few minutes of the podcast today. You and I got law degrees together a long time ago. I went off and actually practiced law for a while. You went off in a slightly different direction and spent most of your career not practicing law, but presumably working with lawyers and experiencing the legal profession, but in a business setting as a CEO, as a founder, and as an investor. And so I wanted to ask you, your perspective over 30 plus years of collaborating with lawyers, being on the other side of tables with lawyers, now having, I know at least some lawyers as colleagues currently at the Naval Academy, how much of what you are teaching and experiencing in your ethics, values, and leadership program does read on to your view of the legal profession itself? Are there ways in which you see lawyers today, new lawyers, practicing lawyers today, getting benefit from some of the styles and pedagogies that you're developing and using at the Naval Academy?
You know, I went to the Naval Academy as a STEM school. We didn't call it that back in the day. It was an engineering school. So I've got an engineering degree. Okay. I can figure out answers to things to five significant digits. I also, while I was at Stanford, I was lucky enough to pay a lot more tuition and get a business degree while I was at getting the law degree. Now, the reason I'm bringing engineering and business and law into the mix here is, you know, as an engineer, I can describe a room in vectors and math. I can actually do the geometry of a room. Okay. In business, I can tell you how that room makes money. It might be a restaurant, it might be a hospital, it might be, you know, some other type of office. So I can actually do the accounting and the finance based on what that room is. In the law, it's very different. You know, and again, it's gonna sound like I'm sucking up to lawyers. I am one. My brother was one. My sister's one. My dad was one. So yeah, I like the law and I like lawyers. Lawyers think about that room in a very different way. And I like the way that lawyers wrap their minds around what that room, it might be the concepts or the ideas that might be discussed in the room. It might be, why is the room there? Or why is the room? I mean, there's so much gray that lawyers have to deal with and, you know, and get to some type of answer. Again, as an engineer, you can get five significant digits, but Mike, I'll tell you, one of the things I've always been really impressed with is, probably 70, 80 years ago, standing at the Golden Gate in San Francisco. Now, you and I know the Golden Gate is that passage between Marin County and San Francisco. It's not the bridge, okay? The bridge is, you know, is kind of a description of a bridge crossing that Golden Gate. Here's the reason I'm saying that. You can, you know, as a business guy, I can talk about the economics of building a bridge there, okay? As an engineer, I can talk about the tensile strength of the steel and all that kind of stuff. I got to tell you, the guy I'm most impressed with is the guy who is standing at that Golden Gate and trying to convince people, engineers, business people, and all that kind of stuff, convince someone that that's where you're going to build the bridge. That's words. That's writing. That's ideas. It's sales, yeah, but it's more words. And the thing that lawyers bring to the table is the ability to understand and craft words that actually move the culture of society. Again, I know I'm overdoing this a little bit, but move people forward with words and ideas. That's what lawyers bring to the table. And that's what hopefully your students remember as they're going through the law school education. There's no right answer necessarily, but try to craft these stories in such a way that it makes sense and it moves people.
Do you think that the curriculum that you're teaching currently at the Naval Academy would be helpful to contemporary law students as they go through the process of emerging into careers where they're in that kind of position of influence and responsibility?
You know, I think so. And at the end of the day, no matter what you do, it really is about the relationships with your colleagues, with the people you're working with your clients, with your sailors and Marines. This is a people business. You know, you got to understand the engineering and the finance, but it really is a people business. So the things that we're trying to teach here and the things my lab is trying to kind of highlight, even though we use a lot of technology to do that, we're boiling it down to the interpersonal relationships that, first of all, we're boiling it down to the head music that you have in your head, the way you're thinking about things. Okay. We're trying to put that mirror in front of you and say, no, you've got to face these decisions and these ideas. You can't just kind of push them aside. Moral perception is what that really is. You can't not see something. You've got to see it and deal with it. And the tools we're trying to deliver here help those students have to deal with hard questions. It could be questions about attacking the hill. It could be diversity, equity, and inclusion questions. It could be legal questions around jurisprudence. I mean, there's so many ways that we're trying to put this message in front of students. And again, what I'm doing is one-on-one with the students. By the way, delivered in the format, in the form factor that most of the students use already. It's not Professor Kingsville out up there, you know, the old guy pontificating on the law. It is in one of the tools I have with that trolley problem scenario. We reduce them to graphic novels, kind of cartoons and comic book looking thing, Marvel Comics. And that's the interaction. We can change the gender. We can change the ethnicity. We can do a lot of different things with these tools to kind of make it a little bit more upfront with the students, delivering them a message and delivering the content in the way they are more used to actually receiving that.
That's a fabulous summary. And both that content that you just described, and a podcast. You do podcasts of your own, for your own program. That's all online. That's all available through the Stockdale Center.
If you don't mind me saying it, you can very easily go to StockdaleCenter.com. One word, StockdaleCenter.com. And our research is up there. Our podcasts are up there. And even the simulations are up there. Go to StockdaleCenter.com/interactive. And you can run through all these simulations we're developing.
Fantastic. So, Michael, let's close it there. I want to thank you so much for visiting with me this morning and sharing your insights and perspective and background on all these topics of shared interest. And it's, as always, great to see you.
Mike, it's a pleasure. Thanks for the invitation. I enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Future Law Podcast. For links to the articles mentioned and to contact the hosts, visit FutureLawPodcast.com.